The European Leadership Forum is a bridge between local Christian leaders' needs and God's global resources. Hundreds of hours of focused Christian thinking are available from teachers like Ravi Zacharias, Don Carson, and William Lane Craig. Go to www.euroleadershipresources.org to find out more and to sign up to our monthly email highlighting resources that can support your ministry.
Okay. For those of you I don't know yet, again, I'm Greg Pritchard, and I'm introducing our speaker today. I'm very excited that he's here. He's one of the leaders in Germany of a leadership movement. He was just telling me this morning that he's on a steering committee of a conference they have for 2,500 Christian leaders that they've been together. They're probably the strongest country in all of Europe that's actually really reflecting on the issue of leadership. So we're really thrilled that he's here with us. He's the head of, in English, the Academy for Christian Leadership in Germany. He has, I think in Germany, I just realized this last year with my friend Dr. Daniel von Wagner, that you had used the two doctors in front. And so we have a double doctor here as well. So I'm going to make it very official. You have to call him Doctor. But has won in mathematics and worked in the business world as a computer scientist, and then did a second one in theology. And so today, he's going to be addressing a topic that's central to the very heart of what we're going to be wrestling with. That is, what is our understanding of human nature? How does our understanding of people affect the way, whole way we approach leadership? And it's one part of three series in this network. We have eight talks. Yesterday was laying out where we are. Today is laying out what is the biblical understanding of leadership, and one session tomorrow on that as well. And then some more practical things. But his is going to be the first one, and this is the topic of his doctoral dissertation. So, you know, he's trying to bring it down for the rest of us simple folks. But we're really glad you're here, and we're very excited to hear what you have to share with us.
Yeah, thank you very much for the warm welcome. So the first slide gives you an overview, the different areas where I try to lead. Some are quite simple, the Academy for Christian Leadership. This is a network of European institutions who offer postgraduate studies and who will work together with the University of South Africa to offer a state-recognized academic degree to those institutions, which is a bit difficult for the evangelical institutions in the German-speaking countries. Now the third one is probably the most problematic one. So I have four children, and sometimes when I would have teached a course for, let's say, on communication, and I come back to my family, and we have some conversation, and then my eldest son would say to me, "Well, you should listen to your course." Yeah, so that's... Actually, I enjoy it because they are really a mirror for me. I mean, you're all friendly people, and people would not object to me. So, or they would say, after the talk, maybe you would go to say to your neighbor that you didn't like the talk, but usually you would not go to me. But my children, they would do that. And so that's, I appreciate that very much.
Do you need your microphone?
Oh, we do, actually,
oh.
Yes.
Put you on. Thank you. Table. This is only for the taping.
Yeah, just for the taping.
Okay.
Make sure you're on. Yeah, power's on. You hooked it on your belt.
Okay. Sorry. Is that somebody in control of that?
Yeah, it does automatically in the system, so we're all set.
Okay, now. Topic is Leadership and Assumption of Human Nature, McGregor's Theories X and Y. So, did anybody hear about this one? Theory X and Y? Yeah. Actually, this was the topic of my dissertation, theology. And if you were a psychologist, you could argue that I would be interested into the X and Y because I first was a mathematician. Yes. Douglas McGregor, he was a social psychologist
from the United States. He was professor at the MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and president of Encirc College. So actually, you got all the slides, but last week I reordered the slides. So you have all of them in your handout, but in a different order, so to make it more exciting. Now, Douglas McGregor, he wrote a book, The Human Side of Enterprise, and he puts a question to top management. He says, the key question of top management is, what are your assumptions, implicit as well as explicit, about the most effective way to manage people? So what do you really believe how people are? Because the way you think about people will influence you treat the people. Now, usually the management people are not very excited about theory. They always said, no, I'm a practical. I don't want to have any theories. Just tell me how to do it. Now, and he said, well, just a moment. Please sit down and reflect. What do you think? How are people like? He says, our assumptions are frequently implicit, sometimes quite unconscious, often conflicting. Nevertheless, they determine our predictions that if we do A, B will occur. Theory and practice are inseparable. So that's his, actually one of the, his main message. In 2000, there was another book about his essays, Douglas McGregor Revisited, and Peter Drucker, who is considered the grandfather of management theory, who actually was an Austrian, now living in the United States for a lot of decades. Peter Drucker says, with every passing year, McGregor's message becomes even more relevant, more timely, and more important. Now, okay, we will now have a look at it. Warren Bennis, I think Warren Bennis is more popular than Douglas McGregor, but Warren Bennis, he is one of his students. He was one of his students, and he writes, just as every economist, knowingly or not, pays his dues to Keynes, we are all, one way or another, disciples of McGregor. Now, McGregor says, actually, in management theory, you have on a wide range of scales, you have two different anthropologies. So the first anthropology, he says, this is theory X. There are three assumptions, and the first assumption is the average human being has an inherent dislike of work and will avoid it if he can. Because of this human characteristic of dislike of work, most people must be coerced, controlled, directed, threatened with punishment to get them to put adequate effort toward the achievement of organizational objectives. The average human being prefers to be directed, wishes to avoid responsibility, has relatively little ambition, wants security above all. So that's theory X, and he developed another theory, which he called theory Y. There are this theory includes five assumptions. The average human being does not inherently dislike work. Second assumption is external control and the threat of punishment are not the only means of bringing about effort toward organizational objectives. So you have to read that carefully. He is not saying that control has no place. He says there is place for control, but it's not the only means to push somebody to do what he should do. Then he said the most significant of such rewards is not financial rewards, but for example, the satisfaction of ego and self-actualization needs. Then there was always the question at that time, how many people are really able to have to fulfill leadership? And he argues in 1960, the average human being learns under proper conditions to seek responsibility, and the capacity to exercise a relatively high degree of imagination, ingenuity, and creativity in the solution of organizational problems is widely distributed in the population. Now, for those of you who are nowadays in the leadership position and who read books on management and leadership, you will all suddenly recognize that all management books today are built on theory Y. But of course, that's 45 years ago. Now the question is, well, if you look at the biblical anthropology, which of the two theories is more biblical? So people who would opt for theory Y, they would say, well, it's creation. If you look at creation, man is made in God's image. But then other people would say, well, we opt for theory X because look at the form. And they would say man is no longer in God's image. So the students who come to our academy, I will always challenge them. For our first course, I will send them the theories to them, and I will challenge them, well, could you please write two pages, which of the theories is more biblical? So sometimes people would say, well, you see, in the paradise, about theory Y. But then it was, after the fall, it is theory X. But now people having the Holy Spirit is theory Y again. And then I would always answer to them, so does this mean you would treat, in a company, you would treat Christians in a different way than you would treat non-Christians? Because they would argue, well, people who have the Holy Spirit is theory Y again. But now, what is with the non-Christians? There are Bible verses used for both theories. So if you look at the Proverbs, for example, if a man pampers his servant from youth, he will bring grief in the end. So that's a clear indication for theory X. Well, if you look at John 15, Jesus says, I no longer call you servants because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends. So you might argue that this does not hold for me because I'm not a servant anymore. I'm Jesus' friends. Okay. Now, if you look at the literature, some people would say, well, theory X is clearly Christian, or theory Y is clearly Christian. So MacGregor himself, he identified Christianity with theory X because of the form. Then Maslow, Abanus, they would say, no, theory Y is Christian. There's some other books who says, no, the whole thing with humanistic psychology and theory Y is clearly anti-biblical. So I was not very satisfied with all these statements because they were only very short statements, and that's why I spent a bit more time in my dissertation. But it was a dialogue between management theory and Old Testament theology. So in this survey, this talk, I would like to give a short survey on the management history, on the theological history, how did Protestantism arrive at theory X, and then we'll have a look at theory X and Y in the light of Old Testament anthropology. Now, the history, actually it goes back to Frederick Taylor, who wrote a book, The Principles of Scientific Management, and which made him the father of scientific management. Frederick Taylor's topic was efficiency. So he was an engineer, and he was very good how to speed up a production of something. He introduced the principle division of labor, which also enabled the invention of conveyor belts. Now let's have a look at his anthropology. His anthropology is, hardly a competent workman can be found in a large establishment who does not devote a considerable time to studying just how slowly he can work, and still convince his employee that he is going at a good pace. So he separated between managers and workers. You see, the time before, usually a worker would have his own tools, and he would do the work the way he thinks it's the best way. Now, he would separate that. I did some studies, and I tell you how to do it the most efficient way. And you're not supposed to think, because there are other persons paid for that. So my father-in-law, who made his apprenticeship in the 30s in Germany, and he was told by his master, well, you're not supposed to think, because the German saying is, "Belasst das Denken in Pferden, sie haben größere Köpfe." So just let the horses think because they have bigger heads. Now, Frederick Taylor, he has a worldwide impact in France, in Japan, also in Russia. I think Lenin was very keen about his theory. And also in Germany, Max Weber, who is considered as the inventor of bureaucracy. MacGregor, he himself learned a lot from Abraham Maslow. You know his hierarchy of needs. It's a different level of needs. So the first need is physiological need. So we have to eat something. Now, this need is satisfied to a certain degree, let's say to 80%, then we'll look upon other needs. Safety, so social esteem, and the top one is self-actualization. Now, the conclusion is that from that is, and that is well accepted nowadays in motivation theory, you cannot motivate people by giving money to them. After the lowest level are fulfilled. Because if the lowest level are fulfilled, it's not giving them more money is not a motivation. And you have studies about that. So if an employee gets more money, so his salary will be increased, you can measure how long this holds, this motivation. It's about 2 weeks. Which is maybe bad news for the business, which is good news for us, because in any case, we have no money at all, so we have to look for other things how to motivate people. Now, this is a more or less direct conclusion from Maslow. He published a book, Motivation of Personality. He founded the humanistic psychology. What is interesting is that he believed in the goodness of human nature. And this is interesting if you look at his biography, because as you can get from his name, he was a Jewish. Because he was a Russian Jewish, so his parents immigrated from Russia to the United States, and he grew up in the United States, but at that time, there was great anti-Semitism in the United States. So as a schoolboy, he would suffer as a Jewish boy. And his brothers and sisters, they changed their first names, so that the people could not get that they were Jewish. But he rejected to do that, and he kept his Jewish name. So even in the 30s, when he applied for the position at the university, he would not get some of the positions because he was Jewish. So that's interesting for me. He really suffered, and he had some hard times as a Jewish living in the United States at that time, but still he believes in the goodness of human nature. Now, Douglas MacGregor, if you look at his history, it's surprising that he grew up in a Christian family, actually in a very reformed Scottish Presbyterian family. His grandfather founded a MacGregor Institute in Detroit. It was a missionary station for poor people, for the poor sailormen around the Great Lakes. And his father, so the father of Douglas, he was the director and lay preacher. And Douglas himself helped there as a young man. So he thought about getting a preacher as his father, to be more involved in church. But he had some conflict with his father about the anthropology. So he is remembering his father preaching and preaching the theory X style. And then he didn't agree to that. So later on, Douglas' wife said about his father, he had a deep concern for mankind, which Douglas shared, and equally deep pessimism in respect to man's potential goodness and strength, which Doug continued to challenge in his work and writings. It is significant that he, as Doug, chose to work with leaders in our society rather than the failures. The father, so the theory X and Y is also a conflict between father and son. And the father worked with poor people who had social difficulties, and the son decides to work together with leaders. Now that's again, we had that before. The purpose of this volume is not to entice management to choose sides over theory X or theory Y. It is rather to encourage the realization that theory is important, to urge management to examine its assumptions and make them explicit. In doing so, it will open a door to the future. Second book, which was published after his death, he says, the answer to the question is, how do you motivate people? Is you don't. You don't motivate people because man is by nature motivated. And today's often people would say, well, the question is not, it's not a question of motivation, but it's a question, how can you hinder demotivation? Yeah? That's what sometimes happens to people. When I started, I was with the Siemens company in Munich at my first career. So when I was started my first job, I was highly motivated. But sometimes, I mean, in a huge company like that, sometimes things happen which will demotivate you. So the question is always, how can you hinder demotivation? Theory X and theory Y are not managerial strategies. They are underlying beliefs about the nature of man that influence managers to adopt one strategy rather than the other. Now, the impact of theory Y is quite overwhelming. If you look at the discipline organizational development, which started in the 60s, the idea of organizational development is that each employee can bring into something knowledge, bring into knowledge into the whole product. Yeah, so nowadays in the industry, you would say, well, we cannot afford that there are only some people, a few people thinking. We have to ask the labor manager to integrate that knowledge into the knowledge of the company. And this is all more or less founded in theory on theory Y. And some try to define the theory Z, but without success. So that's always a temptation. If there is a theory X and theory Y, well, you say, I'm the one who writes the theory Z and take the best of two of them. Now, second part, if you look at the Christian anthropology, now the key verse for all anthropology, Christian anthropology, is of course Genesis 1:26. Then God said, let us make man in our image and our likeness. Irenaeus, the church father, he made a distinction between the two terms, image and likeness. Hebrew terms are zelem and demut. And he said, well, these are two different things. And he said, the image means the natural image, so that there's the capacity to think, the capacity to create something, and so on. This is still there. The likeness, this refers to the supernatural things. And this was lost after the fall. This was Irenaeus' distinction. At that time, in the early church, their anthropology was more optimistic than later on. It changed with Augustine. He said, man by nature cannot want the good. So Romans 7:14. I assume you know the verse. It's the whole passage. The question, what I do and I do not what I want to do. No, that's what it says. Now, so he says that I want to do the good, but I cannot do the good. I don't do the good. And the question is, there's a question between in the New Testament, does Romans 7:14 apply to the Christian or to the non-Christian? That's a big issue. And Augustine in his earliest days said it applies to the non-Christians. And later on he said, no, it applies to the Christian because the non-Christian is so bad that he cannot even want the good. I'm not a specialist in New Testament, but as I understand the discussion in the New Testament today, most New Testament theologians would say, well, it applies to the non-Christian. It's the written from a Christian reflecting his life as a non-Christian. But Augustine still said that man has a free will for the cultural things. Now, the Roman Catholic anthropology builds on Irenaeus' distinction. So the whole system of nature and grace built by Thomas of Aquinas is built on this distinction. And the Second Vatican Council said, man can decide for the good by his free will. It's quite optimistic beliefs in the good of man. Sorry. Martin Luther, he has quite a big struggle with the Roman Catholic Church about the anthropology. He wrote a book on the question of the free will, and he actually says, this is the crucial point. This is the crucial point of the Reformation. It's not the question of the Pope or not the Pope and so on. The crucial point is the anthropology. Now, his teaching is that God's image is lost. Only a small part is remaining. Because he says, and he is correct in saying that, in Genesis 1:26, the image and the likeness, this is just Hebrew parallelism. And both terms are pointing out to the same thing, more or less. But the likeness is just explaining the image. Martin Luther says that man has no free will in regard to heavenly things, but in regard to earthly things. So I have a free will, and I can decide which trouser I will put on. But I can decide freely which woman I will marry. But I cannot decide on my own that I will become a Christian, because it's Jesus who draws me. Man without Christ is even evil when he does good things. If a man happens to do some good, it's by chance. That's Luther's claim. It's commentary on Romans 2:8. The patron word from the mouth of Cicero, virtue grows when it is praised, is rightly scorned and rejected by the Church of Christ. Though the Apostle says the exact opposite, virtue is made perfect in weakness. That is, good works become perfect through patience. For when I'm weak, when I suffer, then I'm strong. So it is human virtue that grows through praise, because it looks for praise. But the virtue of Christians grows when it is reproached and when it suffers, and it comes to naught when it is praised, when it takes delight in praise. So I do not know your situation, but if you happen to be a father, there are no mothers here, no. So if you happen, you will praise your children for what they did, you're not Lutheran. Yeah. Well, you see, the thing with Luther is he was not that systematic. So you can also find other passages in Luther's works. But actually, you also find these passages. And these passages had some influences in the way we think today. Now, the Augsburg Confession, which is the Lutheran confession, they make a clear distinction between heavenly things and earthly things. It's only in the outward acts of this life that they have freedom to choose good or evil. By good, I mean what they are capable of by nature, whether or not to labor in the fields, whether to build a house, take a wife, engage in a trade, or do whatever else may be good and profitable. So that's a clear distinction. So concerning God, we have no free will, but we have a free will concerning the earthly things. You don't find that distinction in the Reformed confessions. So Calvin was even a bit more pessimistic. Calvin says, a man was created in the image of God. In him, the Creator himself willed that his own glory be seen as in a mirror. But you know, from the mirror, you know. Yeah. When we are in the bathroom, we look in the mirror, and our image is in the mirror as long as we are in the bathroom. But as soon as we leave the bathroom, our image is not in the mirror anymore. So Canavan argues that as long man and God was in a good relationship, God's image was a man. But when the connection was distorted, God's image is not in man anymore. Adam bore God's image insofar as he was joined to God, but let's stop now. So he says, sinning is now our only capability. Men with no knowledge of God, when they are judged according to their natural gifts, not one spark of good will be found in them from the top of their heads to the soles of their feet. Now, if you look at the institution, you can get one at the book desk downstairs. He also reflects upon the question, there are some non-Christians who do some good works. So how do you explain that? And Calvin, he has a very clear explanation for that. If unbelievers do some good, it is only because God hinders them to do more bad things. But thus God, by his providence, brings perversity of nature that it may not break forth into action. Now, if you go back to the question theory X and theory Y, now, we are not speaking about believers. We are speaking of human beings as such. Maybe believer or not believer. The question is, does theory X apply or does theory Y apply? Now, this is a clear indication for theory X. Because as you know, the man, he will dislike work and he has no free will to do good work. The Heidelberg Catechism says in question 8, but are we so perverted that we are altogether unable to do good and prone to do evil? Yes, unless we are born again through the Spirit of God. So you see now the difference between the Heidelberg Catechism and the Augsburg Confession. The Augsburg Confession had a clear distinction between heavenly things and earthly things. You don't find this distinction here in the Catechism. I mean, this Catechism is right if you just apply it to the relationship to God. But it's wrong if you look at on the cultural things. So, the question is, does the anthropology of the Reformators concerning the created man really correspond to the Bible? That's a huge challenge now. And I explain why I come to that question. Now, what I experienced is when I started giving lectures in our environment. So in Germany, there are also some sort of a Bible belt in Germany where there are strong evangelicals. And they would always say, oh, you management people, your view on humankind is much too optimistic. And they would excuse me either being a humanist or being a Roman Catholic. So it depends. And that's why I wasn't motivated to have a closer look at that. I understand that the anthropology of the Reformators, they developed their anthropology because of the discussions they had in the question of salvation. And the question is, can man do something for his salvation? And then Luther and Calvin clearly said, no, he can't do anything. It's all sola gratia. And I agree to that. The difficult thing is that we apply this into different contexts. Now, if you look at the concept of image of God, which is a very central concept for Christian anthropology, it's surprising that actually there are only five verses in the Old Testament who have that concept of image of God. It's in Genesis, then after the fall, it's in Genesis 5, and then after the flood, it's in Genesis 9, verse 6. And it's also indicated by the text that these are really parallelistic terms, and they are used interchangeably. But what you also get from this is that even after the fall and after the flood, it's clear for the Old Testament that man is still in God's image. It becomes a bit more difficult if you go to the New Testament, because people would say, well, in the New Testament, the teaching is that Christ is God's image. And that the New Testament says we have to be transformed in Christ's image. And then Luther and Calvin concluded, okay, if we have to be transformed into Christ's image, then obviously we must have lost it before. That's the argumentation. But if you have a careful look at the New Testament, you can discover that the concept of God's image is used in two different ways. So there's also one verse in James and one verse in 1 Corinthians, which is saying that man is still in God's image. So there are two meanings of God's image in the New Testament. The one is God's image, which applies to every created human being, and which is still there. And the other thing is God's image in the sense of Christ's image, which only applies to the Christians, and the Christians have to be transformed into Christ's image. So there's a double meaning of that. Now, what do we learn from the concept of Imago Dei in the Old Testament? If you look at the history of theology, there were a lot of concepts thrown into that word of Imago Dei, which has nothing to do with the context. But if you look at the context of that Imago Dei, Genesis 1:26, let us make man in our image, in our likeness. Then it says they should rule. They should rule about the animals and so on. So the order to rule is connected to the image of God. God was the ruler of the universe, and he says, well, I delegate some authority to you, and you shall rule the animals. And with the order to rule, he also gives the capability to rule. If you look at the Hebrew word zelem, it means that zelem is a stature. If a king puts a stature somewhere, zelem, he says, well, this is like my representative. And man is considered as God's representative on earth. And you get that very clearly from Genesis 2. You see, when God brings the animals to Adam, and then he said, well, you should name him. And naming means, in the Hebrew sense, I have I have power on him. So usually God created the animals, so it would have been his privilege to give the names to them. But then God brings the animals to Adam and says, Adam, you should name them. It also means responsibility, because in the Oriental context, it's very clear if you have the power to rule, if you have the authority to rule, you are also responsible. It's a goal orientation. If you look at Genesis, at the first chapters, it's very interesting how everything is put together in a very systematic way with a very clear goal. You can really see that God acts goal-oriented. Goal orientation is also a very popular management theory today. We call it management by objectives. And it is clear; it has clear, very theological background. It's very different in other religions. And you also can get from Genesis that man has a positive attitude towards work. Now, if you look at Genesis, how God is introduced, he is the one who builds something. He uses his hands. So if you look, for example, in the Greek mythology, in the Greek myths, Greek religion, for the Greek, working with the hands is nothing. Is not something for the gods. The god would not work with his hands. But the Christian God works with his hands. He works. Meaning, being in God's image also implies that we have inherently a positive attitude towards work. And you can get some other aspects. It is very clear that the Old Testament does not know anything about the loss of the Imago Dei. If you look at Psalm 8, which is a marvelous psalm about the part of anthropology. If you look at the center of his psalm, what is the man that you are mindful of him? The son of man that you care for him, you made him a little lower than God and crowned him with glory and honor. So this is in the center of the psalm. And this psalm shows both the low sides, the lowness of humankind, and what is man, but also the highness. You made him a little lower than God. The Hebrew term says Elohim, so it's gods. In some translation, you will find angels, not God. But I understood from the Old Testament scholars that God is the most reliable translation. Now you crowned him with glory and honor. In the Hebrew, there's the word kabod, which is usually only used in context with God, so that the people will come to God and bring kabod to him. But this text says, well, you crowned him with kabod. So this is a very high anthropology within this psalm. We all know that there are also other passages in the Old Testament about the anthropology, which are not quite optimistic. When should I stop to talk?
Well, it depends on how much you get through. You only have 15 more minutes, 14 more minutes. You need to
15?
You have until only 1/2 hour. So
okay.
Break it so that at least there's some time for discussion.
Yeah. Okay. So another 10 minutes, is that fine?
10-15 minutes.
Yeah, okay. The work is paradisical. If you look at the Isaiah, the description of the new world, I want to read that passage because I like that. In the German context, we have the concept of the Schlaraffenland. I do not know whether there's a similar fairy tale in other languages. The concept of the Schlaraffenland is, it's a sort of paradise. You just sit there, and the grilled chicken will flow right into your mouth. You don't have to work at all. You just sit there, and everything gets into your mouth. You don't even have to get up to the kitchen. Now, this is not the biblical idea of a paradise. Isaiah 65. Okay, the idea is they will build houses and dwell in them. They will plant vineyards and eat their fruit. No longer will they build houses and others live in them, or plant and others eat. For as the days of the tree, so will be the days of my people. My chosen ones will long enjoy the works of their hands. So that's what they long for. It's not, they do not long for a world without work. They long for a work without vainless work, so that you build a house and then your neighbor comes and takes it away from you. So what you get from here is that in the Old Testament there's a very positive attitude towards work. So I would argue that God made man in such a way that he has a positive attitude towards work. But on the other hand, if we are in an environment, if we have to work in a theory X environment, then we dislike the work. Yeah? The theory X and theory Y, they are somehow self-fulfilling prophecies. Yeah? If you start a new job, you're highly motivated, and then you know it's a theory X culture. Yeah? So you know there's a strong coercion, a strong control, and so on. So when I did my studies at the university, I used to work in manufacturing, and they had really strict controls. But of course, you always had a way to get out of the controls. Yeah? So you could. You always had some way to get out of the controls. Now, and then you, because you feel controlled, you're saying, no, I will demonstrate that I don't work, but I will only let them think I work. Now, and then, of course, if the owner of the company noticed that, he said, well, you see, I'm right. The people don't like to work, so I have to install more control, even more. Now, that's like a bit self-fulfilling prophecy. Okay, now, looking back to the Old Testament, man is empowered by God's Ruach. There's a marvelous book on the Old Testament anthropology written by a German theologian, Hans-Walter Wolff. It's also translated into English. And if you look, that's actually was, for me, the first time when I reflected my own anthropology. So I, more or less, I had unconsciously the Calvinistic anthropology within me. And I started my theological studies and I came to the book written by Hans-Walter Wolff. And he presents a totally different anthropology. Man is addressed as a responsible being, especially in the Proverbs. Okay, you can read that at home. But on the other hand, there are some negative points. You know, there will always be fools. And there's also a clear indication there's no man without sin. And continuous sinning can hinder learning. So we have, in the Old Testament, with both sides. There were clear statements of the positive things, aspects of man, and clear indications of the negative aspects of humankind. Now, I didn't get into the New Testament, but I'm just quoting Adolf Schlatter, who is a New Testament theologian, who is a very clear, what we would call him an evangelical theologian. He is quite critical about Luther's anthropology. He says Luther misunderstood Paul. He said he would claim, it's the German quotation, that Jesus and Paul did not only see negative things in human beings. Yet, if you are, he understands Paul in that sense, that Paul is saying, well, there are positive things and there are negative things, but the positive things cannot weigh up the negative things. And that's why we are all sinners. That does not mean that we do not do any good work. We do good works. Each person does good works, and each person does bad works. But the bad works does not weigh up. And that's why we are all sinners. So actually, Schlatter is quite critical. In some speech in Berlin, he calls Luther's anthropology a heresy. No, just a quotation from a German songbook, a German hymn, with a praise about the nature. The sense of this is all the nature is very fine, only human beings are bad. That's a song sung in church services. And this is, both statements are wrong. If you look at nature, nature is not only good, there's also evil in nature. And if you look at human beings, no, human beings can also do some good things. I would argue that the anthropology in Protestant churches is often one-sidedly negative. They sing about man as a sinner, but not about man as God's image. The final remarks on theory X and Y. The discussion of theory X and Y concerns the free will in regard to earthly things, not in regard to heavenly things. Man is still God's image after the fall. Thirdly, the humanists emphasized one-sidedly the good in man. The reformators emphasized one-sidedly the bad in man. Just one side remark. It's interesting for the evangelicals. It's always clear. Humanistic anthropology is much too positive. If you look in a book on anthropology from an Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox theologian, they would say the humanist anthropology is much too negative. Okay, the Bible knows about man's good and bad. Even men without Christ can be highly motivated to work and can achieve good things, good in earthly things. So I would argue that theory UI is compatible with biblical anthropology. I'm not saying it's the one you should use. But I would say theory X is clearly once not the biblical one. It's too one-sided, too negative. I would argue the people to reflect upon their own anthropology. But of course, man is not able to do only good things, because everybody also sins. Thus, we need mutual control. And just one remark, both theories are based on assumptions which fit to the Western culture. They are both based on in an individualistic culture which would not apply, for example, to Southern Asia. Okay? So, now I've finished.
Okay, why don't we have a time for questions? Any questions, comments? I'll start it out then. It seems to me the way a question is formulated, it's answered. He who formulates the question answers it, Aristotle said. In this case, formulating it as an XY issue, it seems by the very formulation of this kind of discussion, it puts it within those categories. I think what you're trying to do is try to take it a little bit outside that at the end. But why would you accept those categories to begin with? And when you're thinking about Christian leadership, why don't you build a new category?
Fear said.
No, exactly. I mean, wrestle with this. I mean, there's one question about the reformers and their understanding of human nature, but in other words, don't accept at all the necessity of saying X or Y. Because it seems to me that's accepting somebody else's categories that, in fact, aren't either one of them fully biblical.
I would agree to that. Why didn't I build a new one? Because first thing, the focus of my thesis was just to evaluate McGregor, how he came to that theory, the influence of the theory, and to have a look at it from a biblical perspective. Okay, so to build up a new anthropology is a totally new thing. The other thing is that I think, to my understanding, leadership is a very cultural issue. So you cannot lead in, as we heard yesterday, you cannot lead in Bulgaria as you lead in Germany, as you lead in the United States, and so on. So I think you have to reflect on the anthropology in the context of your culture.
Heaven forbid that an American should defend the French, but I'm not sure that John Calvin got a square deal here, because I think Calvin speaks extensively of the concept of common grace, at least certainly his later interpreters do. And in that, his initial concern is certainly soteriological.
Yeah.
But when he seeks to create a society of people, I think he does accept the idea of common grace. And certainly by the early 17th century, Calvinism is framed in terms of total depravity does not mean man is as bad as he can be.
Yes.
So
his idea, his theological foundation for that is not the creation, but that the Holy Spirit is also working society today. He doesn't draw that back to creation. He said man by creation is now just a bad guy. That's his claim here. Huh? If unbelievers do some good, it's only because God hinders them to do more bad things. So, Calvin would say, well, God sends his Holy Spirit in this society as well, so that the people cannot do more bad things. But by their own, they would do only bad things. I of course, this is also one-sided. I know that. That's just because I wanted to challenge to think about your anthropology. And I know there are other statements from Calvin, but he also did these statements. The difficulty is that if you talk to people from the strict evangelical point, they would say, well, they would argue, your anthropology is not biblical. They would say, well, mine is biblical. They are thinking Calvinistic terms, in these terms, and just identifying Calvinistic anthropology, this anthropology, with biblical anthropology. So that's why I want to challenge them. I agree fully to that. Their claims are fully understandable within the context of the soteriological discussion they had. The difficulty is that if we apply these to other contexts. But that happens. I just wanted to explain how practical Protestantism arrived at theory X.
It seems to me you didn't turn the corner to apply it to leadership or / management. You laid out the argument, but how does this impact how we think and approach people in terms of leading them, in terms of really developing that whole understanding of how we actually do leadership?
Now, if you look at these theories, they have clear practical implications. Now, this is a clear control culture, theory X. So that this is actually what Nick, you spoke about this yesterday, about the communist way of leading. And that's a very strict control culture, wasn't it? So they're clear theory X. You cannot trust anybody. So you have to install controls. And you have to control the controllers, and so on. That's a totally different concept with very practical implications. Now, in that case, in theory Y, you just trust the people, and you empower the idea. The whole idea of empowering, which is now very common in management theory, is more or less based on theory Y. Because theory X would say, well, there is nothing in him which I can empower. And theory Y trusts that there is something within the people which I can empower.
Well, I guess my question is, you never really came to a biblical position that incorporates a full understanding of being made in the image of God, being fallen, and yet understanding that there's the value of the creation and who we've been made to be, and yet understand that we're profoundly sinful, and we can't not only achieve salvation, but we can't do many other things. It just seems to me you haven't really articulated a full biblical understanding of how human beings are and how we should approach it, other than just say theory Y. So you haven't really gone to the place of saying what should be our understanding of anthropology and how does that impact our leadership, which to me seems the natural extension. Yeah. What you've done is raise the question, but you haven't taken us to the point of really adopting a biblical understanding and approach to this.
Yeah, what I did is that I had a look, both theories, how do they connect to biblical anthropology? Actually, I focus on the Old Testament anthropology, to have a focus on the Theseus. So just, there are some indications for both theories, but I think there are more indications for the theory Y.
But it's focused on the theory. It's not focused on scripture or building from a biblical understanding to leadership.
Yeah.
And that's something to me I think you would need to do to make this helpful for people who are trying to think biblically about leadership. You have to come from the scriptures.
Yeah.
And I think there's a legitimate place, at least for mine. I'm just going to put a little bit, hope you don't mind, I'm trying to be a participant as well as moderator. But in this chair, for me, that's what I would think would be really helpful, is for you to wrestle with, there is this, and then we don't want to just buy into being negative and controlling. But then what is a biblical approach and biblical categories? There's a lots of biblical categories in how Paul talks about, I plead with you, I urge you, I long for you.
Okay.
All those relational concepts.
Yeah, that of course, was not my topic. I just...
Yeah. But the biblical anthropology was the topic, too. The biblical...
Leadership anthropology.
Assumption, yeah.
Okay, so that's... What I want to do is just to encourage you to reflect your own anthropology. And just to give an example,
I want to ask if you can say something for motivate people. We as leaders, we try to motivate people. And you presented one way to look how to motivate people by anthropology.
Yeah.
And look to what people are motivated and the bad things and good things. When we are motivating people, which other area we want to look to motivate them? Anthropology one, probably, ethnicity, or what ethnic group or what people group. For example, you are a German, and we know German, they are very disciplined people. We as Romanian were more chaotic in work. So which other area we want to bring in mind, anthropology one, ethnicity and other, to motivate well people on the culture, on different works, some of.
Well, McGregor would say you don't have to motivate people. The only thing is that you have to prevent demotivation. And there is a lot of truth in that. So there's a famous article from Frederick Herzberg about motivation theory. And he says there are some motivation factors and some he calls hygiene factors. Hygiene is the pronunciation correct?
Yeah.
So he says, well, money, for example. Often people will say, well, money is the first motivation. No, no. He says, Herzberg, money is a hygiene factor, which means that if you don't have enough money, you cannot live with this money and you have not enough food for your children and so on, then this is demotivating. But as soon as you have a clear satisfaction, then it will not motivate you to get more money. But there are other motivating factors. One very strong motivational factor is to give responsibility to people. So that to give them the opportunity, what Maslow says, self-actualization. To give them responsibility.
Getting back to just the practical application, I do see some very important application of one's personal anthropology and management. To give an example, in my organization, we have a number of different people who work on issues of policy. I have one individual who always immediately says no. When a missionary asks for something, he also always creates policies to control what he automatically assumes will be the abusive behavior of missionaries to acquire as much out of the policy as they possibly can. So he's constantly trying to create limits in the policy. Then I have another individual who always immediately says yes, because he assumes that the missionary will do the best that he possibly can with the resources he has and not abuse the policies. Mm-hmm. So, in your opinion, of the two types of theories, X and Y, who is right of these two people? and how from a biblical anthropology do we improve the way that we discern these types of matters?
I'm not sure whether this is a theory X or theory Y issue. The theory X and theory Y deals with the anthropology of the leader. What has he in mind? What does he think how people are? In general, there are always exemptions. So I would say, the example you give could fit into both theories. I would say this is not neither evidence for theory X nor other evidence for the theory Y. The question why, I mean, there's one person who says, you mentioned he always says yes. Well, why does he say yes? Is it because he likes the work? Or is it because he fears the punishment? No, I mean, in a theory X environment, you always have people who always say yes because they fear the punishment. Theory X.
No, not what you say, fear of punishment. Because it's for centuries, almost 2 centuries, Germans are the woman is a very disciplined, very hard-working people, very committed to their job. Mm-hmm. And it's not the case in France. Mm-hmm. It's not the case in several other Italy or Spain or southern countries, Eastern mm-hmm. European countries.
Now, I would say in that sense,
I think it's different.
I think in that sense we are good Calvinistic because we believe in the salvation of work. That's interesting if you look at Max Weber's book on capitalism and how the connection between Protestantism and capitalism. There's much truth in it. And so, for us, living means working. For the French people, it's more they work in order to live, but we live in order to work.
Actually, it can be broken down to a Protestant and Roman Catholic mentality
yeah.
in regards to
yeah.
work.
Yes. Yeah.
Or in Greece, you live to have a happy life.
Yeah. Yeah.
To enjoy the siesta or
whatever. Yeah.
How much is management theory being affected by contemporary anthropology, that there's neither good or bad, that there is no X or Y, maybe it's even theory W, who knows what it is, theory 2, I don't know, completely different, that it doesn't fit any biblical category. Is that affecting management, and is it maybe even also affecting my understanding of biblical leadership?
Most management books on management theory I know, they are unconsciously based on theory Y.
So. Both theories start with the average
yeah.
human being in the first sentence,
yeah.
which means that the manager would sometimes, for some people, use another theory. But for the people he's actually making team with, he would always use theory Y.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. That's okay.
And some people he would
yeah.
have to
agree. Yeah. The first assumptions indicate that there can be maybe exemptions. And for these exemptions, for example, you need control and so on. Yes?
Just as a point of interest, in some cultures, the hygiene factors, though, cross over to motivational factors. For example, particularly in North American culture, money is highly motivating because money represents self-actualization. It represents the opportunity to go actualize yourself in some direction that you want.
Yes, but the difficult issue with money is I motivate someone with something he cannot use at the moment he works. Because at the moment I'm in the office, I cannot spend my money. So I work 8-10 hours. Yeah. To spend my money in the night, for example. So, and that's the claim. That's you have to motivate the people with something which gives them satisfaction just at the moment. So you give them the opportunity to create something very a good thing or whatever. To create a new car or whatever, which just gives satisfaction to my needs. It's a question of extrinsic and intrinsic motivation. And money is always extrinsic motivation.
But also the intrinsic motivations in theory Y can be very simple. Like self-actualization can be just... it's common and it's partly can be the... remaining part of the dignity that was given
yeah.
to men, and partly it's just I want to be stronger, better in everything. I want to be more like God,
mm-hmm.
which
yeah.
is completely simple. So it doesn't
yeah.
really distinguish.
Yeah, that's
so
that's
the
correct.
Christian would be aware of his sinful
yeah.
tendencies.
No, that's correct.
And would repent, and someone else to some degree maybe, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it actually it's vice versa. And there are also some other persons. Yesterday I had the workshop on the power addicts, so they would claim that they do everything for God's sake, But actually what they do is self-actualization in the wrong sense.
Well, let's thank so much Volker for this. Okay, we're going to have a coffee break for 20 minutes outside and see if we can wake up a little bit.